It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. School lets out for the day. There are as many as 3,000 teens in downtown Pittsburgh. Now the nonprofit Youth Places, which provides after-school programs, is setting up a program in the David L. Lawrence Convention Center to help reduce loitering downtown. Cynthia James is the president and CEO of Youth Places. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
In recent months, there's been some reporting about crime downtown, whether or not it's on the rise. Is the establishment of this after-school program in the Convention Center a reaction to that?
It's not a reaction. It's being proactive. So a lot of the crime that's happening downtown is not youth-based. It's general challenges of people, you know, of people making poor decisions.
Right.
Unfortunately, sometimes we do have some incidences where kids get into a little scuffle downtown. And over the past maybe 5 or 6 years, it's become a concern, more so not because of the scuffles, but more so because of the amount of kids that are down there at one time. And it's happening during peak business hours, around 2:40 to 5:30. Mm-hmm. There's around 3,000 kids.
Why so many? I mean, there's not that many schools downtown.
No, there's three schools downtown, but those three schools house 1,700 students.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's about 1,700 who take buses through downtown from other local high schools. And so at any given time, kids are getting off buses to transfer to their home buses, or kids are getting out of school and they're going to their bus stop. So at any point, there's clusters of young people just doing what young people do, which is hanging with their friends. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that can be a little challenging for the day-to-day bustle of downtown.
Right. And those clusters can result in some activity that you don't want.
Sometimes.
So is the program as much for the safety, a safe spot for the kids, as it is for avoiding trouble?
Yeah, I would lean heavier on the former, being a safe space for young people.
Mm-hmm.
When we started thinking about this idea of opening a space downtown, we actually interviewed the students first. We did, I would say, a massive focus group, because we got 233 responses from students. And the convening response was, we would love a place to go safely. The main challenges that come up downtown are that kids, if they miss a bus, they're popping into places that don't support kids. You know, that's mm-hmm. just not their nature of their business.
Right.
And so the idea of them being able to pop into somewhere that is designed for them to be safe and have fun, and also get some additional supports that they would normally get back in their neighborhoods if they went home. I mean, if there were still school-based schools,
right,
neighborhood-based schools. So the safe space is more what we're leaning towards. Naturally, 3,000 kids, we have an 1,800 square foot space. We're not going to have 3,000 kids in there. But this is a starting point to see if this is something that the kids really want.
Mm-hmm.
Because, they can say one thing. And of course, anyone who's raised a teen knows that that mind can change in a minute.
Did you notice this, just sort of, where are all these kids coming from?
Yeah.
Did businesses, somebody reach out to you and say, look, we know the success your organization has had in other communities. Can you do mm-hmm. something here?
I think it was a convergence of multiple things. I happened to be downtown at a funding meeting last October. And I said to myself, where are all these young people going? Where are they going? And that, I actually expanded into a conversation with some of my board members and former board members who actually helped start the organization. And then I was pointed to Jeremy Waldrop with the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership,
right,
and Tamara Collier with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And from that time, I have spent time with Jeremy and Tamara and a lot of different groups, the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust,
right,
and a lot of different groups, to think about what's a good resolution, not the final solution for volume right. downtown, but it's a good resolution to start.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did the partnership with the Pittsburgh Sports and Exhibition Authority, which operates the Convention Center, come about?
It really started with, hey, there's a space, so we were prospecting spaces downtown. And that literally came also with a conversation with one of my board members, like, hey, there's a space downtown. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to Mary, Contora, the executive director of the Sports and Exhibition Authority. And from that point, we moved pretty rapidly to get to this board meeting that they just had last Thursday.
Our guest on The Confluence is Cynthia James. She's CEO of Youth Places, which is partnering with the Sports and Exhibition Authority to provide an after-school program at the Convention Center as part of a way to help alleviate loitering downtown. So how does this after-school program at the Convention Center, which is you're hoping to start late next month?
Yes, late next month.
How does that fit into the overall mission of Youth Places?
So we have 22 years in Pittsburgh. We were born out of the Youth Crime Prevention Council that existed in the 90s, when the U.S. State Attorney was Fred Thiemann.
Right.
And it was sort of his and a group of others' brainchild to have some safe spaces. Along with that came the mentoring partnership and workforce. So there were three entities. One was Safe Spaces, which was Youth Places. And those three entities came together and said, hey, we need to have this. And so we've had a successful history of opening spaces where there may be a challenge for young people. Mm-hmm. That challenge in the 90s, of course, was young people having to walk through crime-ridden areas from school to home. Mm-hmm. And now the challenge has shifted because, you know, there's not a lot of neighborhood-based schools. So kids aren't necessarily walking through. They're walking through blight, actually.
Right.
But now they're convening in places where they see their friends. When the neighborhood schools closed, a lot of kids started moving to different neighborhoods. So a lot of kids are missing that home piece where I went to school with my best friend from kindergarten, like we used to. So they're hanging out downtown. They're meeting up downtown. You know, someone might go to Perry, one might go to City High. They're meeting up downtown. And so we've always been the group that comes in and helps to create solutions for young people to be safe and to actually have access to opportunities and programming that they wouldn't normally have access to.
You operate 10 other sites. What sort of programming are you hoping to, do you plan to do at the Convention mm-hmm. Center space?
So we are still in planning phases, but we did receive from the Pennsylvania After School Youth Development Network a grant, one of three awarded in the state for something called a youth hub. And that'll be the only one in Allegheny County. And that youth hub is focused on STEM, mm-hmm. innovation, and entrepreneurship. So one of the programs that we will be housing out of this site will be ways for kids to explore innovation and entrepreneurship from their own brainchild. Mm-hmm. And that'll be an opportunity for them to learn how to incubate their business in a safe space where they can pass or fail in a very safe space for them. And also, naturally, we will have our regular after-school programming, which is tutoring, mentoring, case management support, trauma-informed care, depending on what that student's need is. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the students will just want to come somewhere because they want to be safe for whatever reason, whatever safety means to them.
That's the number one priority?
Right, mm-hmm. right. Whatever they see themselves doing. But there will be different programmatic requirements. We have a lot of STEM partners. We are a part of the Remake Learning Network. We're a part of, we work with Citizen Science Lab, we work with Assemble, we work with Drafting Dreams. So a lot of those partners we've had pre-conversations with about coming down.
We only have a couple of minutes left. How important it is to have the teens' input of what their needs are and how you can engage them?
It's the number one essential success factor of successful after-school programs. You know, we're adults. We sometimes come from places of what we wanted when we were kids, and it's not the same, especially with technology. Technology has changed the entire game for young people. And so the youth input on what they want to do creates more buy-in. They're more willing to show up somewhere where they feel like they created it. And that's how this space came to be, with the kids saying, hey, we want this space.
How long do you anticipate, what sort of hours of operation, how long do you anticipate the kids staying there?
So the kids can stay as long as they want. We also hope to be a great resource for parents who don't necessarily want their children on public transportation all the time. And so we also see that as a drop-in center for parents who can pick up their kids, where there's a safe space for their kid to go. But the center will be open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. because there's a lot of early dismissals, especially with the different schools downtown, the charter school and City High and Kappa. So we see ourselves being 8 to 8, but the after-school hours are generally 2:40 to about 7.
All right. The lease, I understand, is for 5 months. Is
yes.
that correct? Okay. What are you looking for to determine whether the program at the Convention Center should be continued, even expanded?
We're looking at naturally attendance mm-hmm. and how much the business community and other partners feel that we've been able to have some impact on the amount of volume where kids hang out at.
And are you getting support from downtown businesses?
We're starting that process. We really need that support. The first two supporters were the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust and the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. They invested financially in the initial market studies around this work. So we're hoping to expand that so that there can be resolution for everyone, a positive resolution.
Cynthia James is the president and CEO of Youth Places, which will be operating an after-school program in the Convention Center to help reduce loitering downtown while offering students a safe space. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. A little more than a year ago, a grand jury report was released accusing 300 Pennsylvania priests of sexually abusing children. What has the Pittsburgh Diocese done to help survivors and prevent further abuse? And the State House returns to session today. We'll take a look at what's on the agenda, including work requirements for Medicaid recipients and a bill that could change the life without parole sentence in the state. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Yo! Don't tell Pittsburgh rocker Joe Grashecki, but there was once another band called the House Rockers, formed by bluesman Jesse Hill in 1951. In 1960, Hill released a song called Oop Poop Padoo, and his fellow New Orleans citizens ate it up, selling over 800,000 copies and launching it atop the charts. The song has been covered at least 100 times through the years, including a version recorded for HBO's Tremé by James and Troy Trombone Shorty Andrews, his grandsons. Jesse Hill passed away on this day in 1996. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. For more than four decades in Pennsylvania, life sentences have been without parole. That will change for some inmates if state lawmakers pass a controversial bill. Keystone Crossroads contributor Aaron Mozell reports.
The new bill would give more than 1,000 people convicted of murder something that doesn't come easy in Pennsylvania, a chance at freedom. To inmates and their families, that would be a gift, a godsend.
So it's Schilk, S-C-H-I-L-K, Bierman. B-I-E-R-M-A-N.
Joanne Schilk Bierman's brother Tom was convicted of second-degree murder in the mid-80s. During a night of drinking, he lured a tourist back to his West Philly apartment building with the false promise of a sexual encounter. His intent all along was to rob him. He stripped the man naked, bound him, then went downstairs. While Tom was gone, the man fell from a third-floor window and died from severe head trauma. Tom got a life sentence. Joanne was devastated. In the space of 7 years, she buried two siblings, and now it felt like she was losing a third.
It's like a great sense of loss and grief again all over.
Inside Joanne's small Bucks County apartment, you see walls and shelves filled with things that make her feel close to her brother. For years, he was the most consistent male figure in her life, even when he was in the throes of drug addiction. There are framed photographs, but also paintings and stencil work Tom created in prison.
Having something that he actually had his hands on is so important to me. You know, like just knowing like the card that he sent to me, he physically had this card in his hands. And now it's like kind of a sense that I'm getting to touch what he touched.
In the bill, Joanne sees an opportunity for families to have more than mementos, more than monitored phone calls, more than monthly prison visits.
Not saying that any crime's okay. I'm not saying that. I just feel that people deserve a second chance. I feel like we all deserve a second chance.
The bill applies to people convicted of first-degree murder, intentionally killing someone, as well as people locked up for second-degree murder, which in Pennsylvania can mean you participated in a crime that ended someone's life, whether you pulled the trigger or not. The getaway driver, for example. Inmates sentenced to life for first-degree murder would serve 35 years before qualifying for parole. Inmates serving for second-degree murder would have to wait 25 years. The bill's prime sponsor, State Senator Sharif Street, a Democrat from Philly, says no one will be paroled automatically.
For the people who deserve to remain in prison, My bill does nothing to say that they will be released. It simply gives the Board of Probation and Parole the ability to sort it out.
Tom Schilk thinks the bill would help right-size the state's criminal justice system.
Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Just getting roused. Yep,
I talked to Tom over the summer on a crackly phone line from state prison. He told me rehabilitation has diminishing returns, that more years behind bars don't necessarily equal more personal growth, and that he's felt ready to return to society for a long time.
I know, Aaron, I can never really rebalance the scales. The harm I've done is irreparable. I realize that. But I would like to try to do good. I would like to try to help people.
And so why not give inmates like him a chance to be paroled? Wilfredo Rojas, a former prison social worker, has a blunt answer. They don't deserve that. To him, it's enough that these inmates, particularly those convicted of first-degree murder, are alive and breathing, that their families can visit them.
Personally, I believe in forgiveness, but forgiveness has to come with some kind of consequence. There has to be some kind of punishment imposed.
Wilfredo's feelings are rooted in deep pain. His son Alejandro Rojas Garcia was murdered in 2015 after a night out with friends. A stranger he had an argument with shot up his SUV as he drove away. He was 34 years old, a father pursuing a marketing degree at Temple University. Alejandro's mom, Aleida Garcia, was at work when two detectives delivered the bad news.
They didn't tell me what happened. They just said that he had died. And I just fell to the floor screaming.
Aleida says it took a long time for the initial shock to fade. Months went by before she could muster anything more than a blank stare. Wilfredo was just as gutted. He says he understands Tom Schilk's argument, but he just can't get behind a bill that would potentially let people like his son's killer go free, even if they've been reformed after 35 years in prison.
Will they be corrected? Probably. But the issue again becomes you hurt somebody else. You uncorrected my life. My life is not correct since that murder.
Street's bill faces a tough road. Previous efforts have failed to get out of committee. The state's Office of Victim Advocate is strongly against it. And Governor Tom Wolf hasn't taken a position. Aaron Moselle, Keystone Crossroads.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 13 months since the Pennsylvania grand jury report accused hundreds of priests of abusing more than 1,000 children across the state, including in the Diocese of Pittsburgh. Bishop David Zubik announced steps to strengthen efforts to prevent child sexual abuse. But what will that look like going forward? Joining us in studio is Jane Sarah, leader of the Secretariat for Protection of Children, Youth, and Vulnerable Adults. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
And separately, the diocese has also been consolidating parishes, which has caused maybe a separate angst among some Catholics. Linda Ritzer is the leader of the Parish Services Secretariat, which is working with parishes on those mergers. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy to be here.
Let's start with you, secretary. That's a formal term used by the diocese. What does it mean? Is this an office, a department? What does it mean?
Yes, it's an administrative office that is in support of the bishop's ministry. So really, we are going out, those of us who are working in the secretariat's going out on behalf of the bishop to support his work.
Jane, the Secretariat for Protection of Children, Youth, and Vulnerable Adults went into effect in April of this year. What does that secretariat do?
Yes, you are correct. The secretariat began on April 1st, and the role of that secretariat is to really support the victims and survivors as we go forward. And in addition to that, we have created four offices that are part of that new secretariat. And those offices have certain responsibilities. So the first office is the Office of Victim Assistance. And that office has really been in existence in the diocese since 1993.
Yeah. So how do you assist victims? Is it emotionally? Is it in terms of finances? What does that entail?
We do provide counseling services. That is one way to the victims and their families. The second way is through the Office of Accompaniment, which we have just recently created as part of the Secretariat. We will be providing spiritual and pastoral healing programs in all of our parishes. And in addition to that, we are going to be setting up survivor groups across the diocese where different survivors can come and be part of that.
What is the role in rebuilding trust after these reports? Is that one of the biggest challenges?
Yes, I believe it is, because after the grand jury report came out, we had a lot of issues relative to transparency, accountability, integrity, and trust. So through the development of the Secretariat and through the different offices that we have, and also the transparency and accountability we will have going forward, we feel very much that we hope to build that trust back up in our diocese.
Let's focus a little bit on transparency. Transparency in what? In terms of the accusations that have been made, the steps that have been taken after accusations are made? What?
One would be in the accusations and being able to identify and realize, you know, as noted, as it was noted in the grand jury report. But I also believe transparency as it relates to financial transparency. So we, as part of that, have done a great job as the disclosure of financial records and being able to really identify where we are as a diocese so that the public really understands.
Is it financial records regarding maybe payments, compensation to victims?
Disclosure of the financial records or status of central administration in the diocese is very important. And also, we also disclosed in June of this year, at the end of June, beginning of July, we did disclose what payments were to victims over the years as we began to pay out to different victims and so forth for clergy allegations.
How long are payments going on? We've heard about the creation of the Victims Compensation Fund earlier this year, I believe it was in January. But how long had been the diocese been maybe making compensation payments?
The diocese has been making compensation payments ever since the 90s, so it's been a long period. The compensation fund is totally separate and independent of this secretariat. And so we still have the compensation operational, and it will be till the end of September with anticipation that we will disclose sometime in January.
Mm-hmm. So the transparency regarding financial, is that just to answer members of the diocese questions, where's my money going or what?
You know, Bishop Zubik identified the fact that, because I know there was concern by many people, we were using parish funds or we were using funds from Catholic Charities or using funds from the capital campaign. That is not where the funding source has come to be able to pay out for the victims and survivors.
Where's it coming from?
It's coming from our insurance fund because we are self-funded at the diocese, and through our insurance companies, we are able to go ahead and pay out the compensation.
Have you received any skepticism regarding how this office might protect kids when members of the Secretariat were part of the administration where numerous priests were accused of abuse?
So as I mentioned to you, the one individual has been with the office since 1993. And actually, we see a lot of value to that because she's been able to bring over a wealth of knowledge as we began to start this new secretariat and take a look at what the accusations have been from 2019 and going forward. So we see a lot of value. The Office of Compliance, which used to be the Office of Safe Environment, that individual has been in that role since 2015. And there's been value in that because we've been doing background checks since 2007 in the diocese.
In speaking with the leader of the organization called Catholics for Change in our church, he suggested that maybe there would be greater trust if some of the folks from outside of the diocese, but members of parishes, were part of the whole oversight process. What do you think about that?
Well, I will tell you what we have established is called the Church Healing Commission. Representation on that was very thoughtfully selected as we went through the selection process. And so we have individuals from law enforcement, we have Catholics and non-Catholics with a Lutheran minister and also a Methodist minister as part of it. We also have individuals on there, safe environment coordinators, youth ministry coordinators. We have a victim who's part of that. compliance officer, and it's a 12-member commission. We had our initial meeting in the end of July, and we will continue to meet four times a year, bringing to this commission, which is a lay commission, all of the work that we've done as part of the Secretariat.
Our guests on The Confluence are Jane Sarah, leader of the Secretariat for Protection of Children, Youth, and Vulnerable Adults within the Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese, and Linda Ritzer, leader of the Parish Services Secretariat, which is helping parishes with ongoing mergers. Jane, what is it that somebody should do right now when they want to report abuse? Should they go directly to law enforcement or what? What is the diocese advising?
We absolutely advise that you definitely go to law enforcement first, but we also have a toll-free number in the diocese, which is a 1-888-808-1235, which is our hotline. And then they can also call our offices directly at the Office of Victim Assistance, which is the office that initially takes any allegation of clergy sexual abuse. And then, of course, it should be reported to the Pennsylvania Child Line.
You mentioned the Victims Compensation Fund just a couple of minutes ago. There is a deadline coming up. And why is there a deadline? What happens if somebody wants to file a claim after, is it September 30th?
Yes. So the Victims Compensation Fund began in January. The last day for filing will be September 30th. That doesn't prevent anybody from having any interest in filing a concern with the diocese on a clergy allegation. This is just if you go directly to the fund, which operates totally separate through the independent firm that we have.
In the past, Bishop Zubik has opposed opening a window for lawsuits where the statute of limitations to file suit has expired. Is the diocese still opposed to that?
I'm not sure if I can answer that right now at this point in time. I know we've had some internal discussions relative to it.
Let's bring Linda back into the conversation. Briefly, tell us, where is the diocese on this multi-year consolidation process?
So we began that process in April of 2015, and we have been working very closely with people going through the process of determining what would be the best model to be employed in a particular region throughout the diocese to really come to that point where we can provide the best ministry possible for all of our people.
But aren't the reasons for that the retirement of priests, the lack of the numbers of priests, but also declining attendance at some of these church buildings?
There's no doubt that some of the demographical situations that we're facing with declining numbers of people, people moving to the south, people moving to the west, that the number of clergy available to us and subsequently the financial resources that we have are impacting how we best serve our people. So we're trying to make adjustments to the realities that we're facing.
Where are we in this process?
In October, the groupings, as we call them here in the diocese, took place. And really what that is a compilation of parishes coming together under the leadership of a single administrator and clergy team. So each one of those groupings are moving at somewhat of a different pace. For example, Bishop announced six new parishes that began in July of this year. Bishop did announce at the very beginning that we would have up to 5 years from that October 2018 date to really come to the completion of the merger process.
At this point, realizing still fairly early in this process, have the combinations, have the groupings impacted efficiency in the diocese as of yet? Have they streamlined finances any for parishes that have combined to this point?
Yes, each administrator is looking at the situation within his grouping. He's beginning to realign staff commensurate with financial resources and also trying to build a vision for what that particular local setting might need. So we want to invest in ministry that really touches the heart of what's happening in the area that people find themselves.
To both of you, what role do both of these issues we've been talking about, the parishes merging, the diocese's response to accusations of abuse and the grand jury report, what do they play in the future for the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh and its ability to survive? Jane?
Well, I think if you take a look with the clergy sexual abuse situation and the ability for the church to survive, and we realize that some people may have left the church simply because of what has occurred as part of the grand jury report, our secretariat is going to be very active in trying to get those individuals to understand, you know, what is necessary going forward. How do we put some healing programs in place for them? So we hope to get a lot of those people back. We want it to be a more welcoming environment as we move forward, because we recognize the fact that there are some people who have left the church, you know, over this situation.
Linda.
So we will work to try to adapt to the situation that we find ourselves in. We might have to change our approaches to how we do church. For example, I think we really are faced with an opportunity to start thinking about ways that church has to go outside of the walls of a particular building, out to the people, the youth, the elderly, the broken, the needy, in ways that we may never have really done that before.
Even though the past is behind us, some people never forget. And so what we want to try and
do... Well, should the church forget? Should the diocese forget?
No. We don't want to forget about the past, but I think what's important is we want to be able to move forward with the changes we're going to incorporate so that we can get people to come back to the faith, but let them to understand that it will be a better place as we move forward, but they have to work with us and move forward with us. You know, even though it's a very sad past, it's been devastating for many people, you know, when the grand jury report came out. But we want to help these people move forward. And I think moving forward and taking that type of an approach will help us to move our faith forward as well.
Jane Sarah is the leader of the Secretariat for Protection of Children, Youth, and Vulnerable Adults within the Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese. Linda Ritzer is the leader of the Parish Services Secretariat, which is helping parishes with mergers. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Members of the Pennsylvania House returned to session today following a summer recess. Monday, state senators return to Harrisburg. Let's check on that list of legislative priorities with WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief, Katie Meyer. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
So, Katie, will the third time be the charm for Republican senators who want some work requirements for Medicaid recipients? Governor Wolf vetoed two earlier versions. Remind us why.
The governor has long been an opponent of work requirements for Medicaid recipients, and he essentially said he does not think there should be work requirements. These would affect people who are able-bodied, technically people who are covered under the Medicaid expansion that happened under President Obama. And Republicans have, you know, long held that that expansion was an overreach, that it shouldn't have happened, and that people should not be covered under it. And so this would, you know, aim to give them, you know, to institute some requirements that they fulfill in order to get medical coverage. The governor opposes that, so he has vetoed two bills, you're right, in the past, and it looks like he will probably do the same for this one as well.
Okay, so what is different, according to the sponsors, about this third attempt?
So there are sort of two sides to this. There are... In any of these bills, there are some exemptions. So, for instance, if a person is, you know, a mother or a parent, a sole parent of a minor, then generally they are not affected by work requirements. Likewise, if they're elderly or if they're under 18, they're not affected. So they added some new exemptions. For instance, being designated medically frail, which is a specific definition that varies state by state. But basically, if you have complex medical conditions or ongoing medical conditions, you could be exempt. Other stuff on that, I mean, they are trying to make it, you know, a little bit broader or what people can do to fulfill work requirements. So before they could, you know, literally just work or look for a job. Now they've added volunteering, things like that. And they said you can sometimes volunteer, sometimes work if you want. So they've tried to make it a little bit more flexible.
Do the sponsors of these bills think there is waste or even fraud in the Medicaid spending?
The argument that I hear from them most often is that the cost of the program keeps going up, and they think it's too much of a burden, that it's going to become unwieldy in the long term, and so they need to cut down costs in some way. So they look to the expansion population to do that.
And this, remind us, is not just a state action. Work requirements would also need federal approval. Is that not correct?
That's true, yeah. And it's actually, so states didn't used to be allowed to institute work requirements. That's a new thing under the Trump administration. It went into effect last year. And not too many states have done it so far. So far, 16 have applied, 9 have been approved. So Pennsylvania would be added to that list.
The governor and some Democrats have been pushing for gun control measures for years. Mm. Is there any appetite for any such control in the House and the Senate?
Good question. The one bill that looks the likeliest to have some action, to get some, you know, have some progress in the legislature is colloquially usually called a red flag bill. It's officially called an extreme risk protection bill. Basically, it would give police a search warrant. Well, it would let family members request that a court temporarily take away weapons from a person who might be, you know, dangerous to themselves or others, maybe suicidal. So they would get what's known as an expedited hearing. They could have their firearms seized after that, and that could be for 3 months to a year. Now, the House has been really cagey about whether they're going to support this bill. It's got some Republican sponsors. It's got a lot of Republicans who oppose it. Most Democrats are more or less on board. So the House is going to be the big one to watch on that. It's unclear what they're going to do with it.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to touch upon minimum wage. The administration's proposal to raise the minimum wage got nowhere this spring. I spoke recently with the Senate Democratic leader, Jay Costa. He said maybe, quote, we went after too big of an increase over too short of a period. What are the chances that minimum wage is even revisited during the fall time?
Great question. I know Democrats are going to continue rallying for it, pushing for it. It's one of the governor's main issues, so they're obviously going to be continuing that push. Watching Republicans on this, we've seen some signs that maybe the Senate Republicans would be willing to consider a compromise. Jake Corman, the Senate Majority Leader, has said it needs to happen, that conversation, but we haven't seen it so far, so it's unclear what would start that.
Are they even talking numbers about what it could go up to?
Not really. We haven't gotten that far. I mean, the governor's proposal was an increase to $12 an hour right away and then gradually up to 15. Republican leaders said they were very clear that they thought that was way too high. And so maybe they would consider something in like the $8.50, $9 realm, but I don't want to speculate too much. You know, we should just say as of now, Pennsylvania's $7.25 minimum wage, the federal minimum. It's lower than any of the states that surround us.
Right. I believe the difference is more than a dollar as much as $3 or more per hour. In our final minute, Katie, now that the Trump administration is rolling back clean water regulations, there seems to be a push to increase requirements here in Pennsylvania. Briefly, how so?
So I actually am covering that today, so we will have more details at the end of today. But my understanding is there are several things that environmental advocates in Pennsylvania would like to do. Stricter caps on methane would be the one that we're watching right now. So we'll see exactly what the details of that plan might look like and whether the governor gets on board with it. And then, more importantly, whether Republicans get on board with it. Generally, they have been averse to increased regulations like that.
In a sentence or so, any other items on your radar for the next couple of months in the legislature?
Oh, those are the main ones. But there are, you know, always a couple things to be watching. There's a child sexual assault bill that would extend the statute of limitations that's been stalled in the Senate for a long time. Reforms to sentencing and probation and parole are going to be interesting to watch. And then we already talked about guns, but we'll see if any other gun-related measures come up and get some traction.
Katie Meyer is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief. We look forward to your coverage on these issues, Katie.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Harry Potter series and books by Judy Blume were among the writings that have been banned from libraries by churches and community groups in the United States. Next week is National Banned Book Week, and we'll discuss why children's and young adult books are often prohibited. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.